here we go.
Welcome back to Here We Go with Todd McComas. This is it. This is Here You Go. It's Here We Go. And this is me. I'm Todd McComas. So I don't know what you were expecting. If you're expecting something else, then you clearly picked the wrong damn show. So little business up front. If you like hearing my voice over a microphone, you can do so live. The 29th and 30th, January 29th and 30th in Kansas City at The Improv. You can go to toddcomedy.com. There's clearly a calendar there with that show on it. Hit event details and buy tickets, and it takes you right to where you need to go. January 29th and 30th, Kansas City. Haven't sold very many tickets yet. I don't know if I'm getting less popular or if it's just a pandemic thing, but if you think you might want to go, they do it safely. You will not get COVID, I assure you, if you obey the rules that they set in place. And we'll have a good time. So come hang out. Joining me today, one of my best friends in the world, former business partner, one of the funniest comedians I know, Chris Bowers. Thanks for being here, buddy.
What's up, man? I don't know how you can guarantee no one will get COVID. That's an impressive
if
guarantee.
They follow the rules. That's my disclaimer. I can't control what you do once you're in there, so that's on you. But if you wear your mask when you're not at your table, I think you'll be okay.
You'll probably be fine.
Reports say you'll be fine. you know, it's funny because I do like this is going on right now. And you and I have talked in great detail about this. Everybody's scared. They're scared to go out into these places. But when you look at states like where you live now, California,
yep,
where they really shit the bed and got too tight, you can't go anywhere. And then numbers skyrocketed because people were having house parties and congregating in less regulated ways socially.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to do something. I don't know what that is. And one of the sad things in my life, and you know this through owning comedy clubs with us, is when I'm not in charge, I tend to think I know exactly what we should do. And the minute you put me in charge, I have no fucking idea how to make things successful. So I don't know. I mean, I was in Florida this week and they don't care at all. And I live in California where literally everything's closed. And they're both skyrocketing numbers, so I just don't know if that's the answer.
You know, I mean? It's crazy,
but I don't know. I mean, again, I don't know if more people would have died if California would have, like, if closing everything down saved us somehow because we would have had. I mean, there's more people come to California to visit, not in Florida, I guess, but I don't know. Again, I have no concept of what's going on.
It's a bizarre time, and you love comedy probably more than anybody I know, right?
I'm a big fan.
When you say. And you've been into the business of comedy. You've seen how the sausage is made. You're still a stand-up comedian, but you've been one for what, 13 years now?
08. So probably, yeah. So 12 years as an official. I mean, I did my first open mic in 96, but I didn't get serious about it till 08. So
right.
I kind of dicked around for 12 years, just kind of do an open mic every 3 or 4 years. Or I do a feature weekend or something with Richie Reagans or something weird. But like,
right.
As far as like, nah, I got divorced and I'm like, all right, I'm going to try to do comedy. And then a year into that, we bought Morty's in Indianapolis. And eventually we owned a club in Louisville and a club in Dayton. And yeah, it was interesting to see both sides of it because you get emails from comics that don't get how it all works. And
right.
And a lot, like anything else, you don't know how it works either. It's just like, oh, wow, okay. You know,
it's so crazy. And, you know, if you've touched on it a few times on here, I think, but like the Kostaki Kanamapas, we were breaking it down with him. Like, it's so crazy what does sell and what doesn't. And just being hilarious doesn't guarantee you're going to sell one ticket.
Right.
And if you can talk to the dead, you're probably going to sell out that damn show, you know? Like I was telling him, like I followed a medium when last year in Kansas City, I think the week before I was there, it was a medium and she sold out the whole weekend, like at a comedy club. So it makes us sad, but yet we both were on the business side as well. So, you know, like, hey, I probably would have I would allow cult meetings in here that worship right. Satan if enough people would show up and spend money.
Well, the medium calls everybody's house and then says their grandfather who just died wants them to go to see the show. So I think she has got a leg up in marketing that we don't have because we can't be like, hey, did someone just die that has an R in their name? And they're like, well, my dad's name was Robert. He just died. Yeah, he wanted me to tell you should go to the comedy club and see Todd McComas this weekend. Like, we don't have that kind of deal. I mean, you know, but that was the other thing funny that when I owned the comedy club, people would send me an email and be like, you should book me. I kill. It's like, well, everyone kills. This is the major leagues, man.
Right.
Like, I'm not booking people. Yeah. Every comic we pay to do this is a killer. That's the whole fucking point.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, it'd be like me calling the New York Mets and being like, I should play outfield. I never drop a pop fly. Yeah. It's the major leagues. Nobody drops pop flies. They catch everything.
Right.
What else do you bring to the table? And that's the thing. You got to bring other stuff to the table, which is, because I don't think people understand, I mean, how much money there is, you know, whether it's credit card processing fees or, you know, rent. I mean, and people think, oh, these comedy clubs are making all this money. Ugh. I mean, you know, we owned three comedy clubs at one point. We owned four comedy clubs for 3 weeks. We had a fourth one. And I think from when we bought them in 08 till we sold them all in 16 or whenever we got rid of the last one, I probably lost 90 grand.
Sure. Easily.
Easily.
Yeah.
That's not including, and Tony probably lost about that, and Steve lost about that, and you lost about that. You know, so it's not like the comedy club's screwing us and taking us. It's like, the comedy clubs aren't making any money, guys. They're open for 6 hours a week.
Right. And you justified it well. It's like, you know, some people pay 30 grand a year to join a country club, you know, golf.
Yeah, that's what my dad told me, you know, when I was – I'm like, am I being stupid for putting 20 grand a year into this stuff? And he's like, well, you know, treat it like a hobby, not a business.
Yeah.
Adults spend 20, 30 grand a year on their hobbies, whether it's fixing their car or whatever the hell they're fixing up old cars or whatever they do. So I'm like, all right, I'll just – you know. But there wasn't a lot of money in it. But I think there's – most bars, there's not a lot of money in.
Sure. I just remember how frustrating that was. We would have a great month or something. We're like, we got some money in the bank. And then Tony would be like – oh, yeah, well, we had to renew the liquor license, so that money's gone. Like, every time we would start to see a positive, there would come a big expense.
Well,
it would zap it.
Well, and you know, we got it behind a little bit at a time, and then we got in that debt maintenance circle where it's like, I mean, you know.
Sure.
The stat always tells me this. I mean, we used to pay $11,000 a year in overdraft fees because we just didn't have enough cash.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the big lie I think that rich people sometimes won't tell you is that what I learned owning businesses is – it's pretty easy to make $1 million into $2 million,
right.
But it's pretty impossible to make $10,000 into $100,000.
Right.
There's just a point where, like, when you've got enough money to do things correctly, you can turn that money into more money. But when you have barely enough money, I mean, you know, I tell the story all the time. When we first opened the comedy club, we spent all the money we had buying it and stocking it once. And literally we had a couple hundred dollars in the checking account after that. And so, like, on Thursdays, I would go to the hotel and I'd pay in cash the hotel for Thursday night, not for the whole weekend, just for Thursday night. And then Friday morning, I'd come back with the money from Thursday night and pay for the hotel rooms for Friday. And then Saturday, I'd come back with the money from Friday and pay for the hotels for Saturday. I mean, we never had any money.
It's a lot like how I live my life right now, like, to be honest, fucking COVID. But I tell you, I was glad that we did it. And you did it longer than I did, but I got to jump in on the last run of it. And don't you think, like, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I know more the business of comedy now. Like, I know everything full circle, and I feel like it makes me a better comedian.
Yeah, I think it definitely, you understand. I mean, and, you know, people are like, I have comics all the time. Well, you owned a club. How do I get booked? And I'm like, well, I don't know that either. The only thing I ever found to get booked was by the club, and that only worked half the time.
Learn to talk to the dead.
Yeah.
I would tell them.
Exactly. You know, but I think that there is, I mean, it did teach me, I mean, the ins and outs of it. And just, you know, how it all works and, you know, that like even a guy, you know, say Donnie Baker, he's going to sell out 1 week in a year. He couldn't sell out 4 weekends a year.
Right.
It's one of those things. I mean, even great big acts. I mean, it's not like you know, it's just weird. I mean, I said this before on podcast with you specifically, but, you know, being a comedy club booker is the closest I'll ever come to understanding what it's like to be a woman. Because, like, the way I describe it is the people that you want to call you back never do. and the people that have no fucking chance won't leave you the fuck alone.
Right.
How many people send you emails every day about how good they are? We both booked. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm going to murder, you know, but, and then like you look at their tape and it's like, this is awful.
Yeah.
You know, and then they're the ones that email you every single week. But then you try to get, you know, it took us 6 years to get Bert Kreischer in the building.
Oh, yeah.
He would book and then have a TV thing come up and have to cancel. It wasn't his fault, but I mean, still, like, you know, so I totally.
it was great, like, our little victories, though. I remember, like, Chad Daniels. We really wanted Chad Daniels at the club. And we had heard that he was on the outs with Crackers Comedy Club, which was here. So we reached out to him and we're like, hey, we like overpaid. We paid him over $1,000 for the weekend, more than we knew like he was getting for working Crackers,
right,
just to have him, like, and but to get him, and then he became a regular on our roster. We were like, fuck, I mean, it felt so good to have that control and make that happen. You know, like he was one of our guys, like one of the guys we looked up to. Like, he's one of the best in comedy, and we finally got him. Like, those were the moments behind the scenes that I lived for.
Well, and that was my favorite part of owning the comedy club, honestly, was, and I used to tell people all the time, me owning a comedy club was like a regular dude owning an NFL football team and deciding who starts the games. Like, that would be kind of fun. So, like, I loved that, like, yeah, Chad Daniels was one of my favorite comics, and so we got to book him and then watch him work for a whole weekend.
Yeah.
That was the cool part of watching, you know, I mean, and just all, I mean, you know, picking up Gilbert Godfrey from the airport and like all this guy, you know, Gilbert Godfrey calling me at 4 p.m. going, can you go buy me a sandwich? Sure, Gilbert. What kind of sandwich? Like, I don't know. Tuna on rye, I think. No, light mayo. And I'm like, all right, Gilbert, you know, so, or you know, we
you're like, this is so bizarre.
Yeah. It's just a weird, you know, the week that Skippy from Family Ties slept on my couch, you know, in between gigs or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, there's just, there was so many moments where it's like, I can't believe this is what's happening in my life. This is great.
Right.
So it was a lot of fun. I had a great time and I met a lot of cool people. And, you know, I think I really helped my comedy. I got the ability to get on stage whenever I wanted and, you know, a good stage,
sure,
you know, yeah, but I wasn't happen to go to a shitty open mic with three people at it. I could go to a show that, I mean, even our open mic, which wasn't great all the time, at least always had 15 or 20 people that were there for comedy. At least it was.
Yeah. And you're on a real stage in a real room.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I remember, I liked bumping into people like celebrities, like getting to work with them or whatever because of the club. Like, I remember, do you remember this when, I accidentally texted Tim Meadows? I thought I was texting Tim McLaughlin. A buddy of ours who's a comedian. And it was something like riffing back and forth or something. No, he had posted something on social media and I saw it and I went to text him. I was like, something like, quit being a little bitch, pull up your pants and start over, that. And I went to Tim Meadows by mistake. And then he just texted me back and he was like, wrong Tim? And ? And I was like, I am so sorry. I'll delete your number from my phone. I only had it for picking him up, you know, for the shows. But I love the moments like that. And
I was taking Tim Meadows to Kokomo for a gig once, and it was snowing real bad. And it was the week that, like, I don't know, I think it Nelson Mandela had just died and somebody else real famous had died. You know, celebrities die in threes or whatever. So I was thinking to myself, oh, I wonder if when you're a celebrity and two people die, if like you're nervous for a while until the third one dies. Like, I could see that being like a thing if you're a celebrity, like, oh shit, you know? And so, but it's like, we're a blizzard. I'm driving Tim Meadows and I'm having that thought about it. And I'm about to ask and I'm like, oh my God, what if I kill Tim Meadows? Like, where are this snowstorm? I can't really see. I might, like, cause that, and then you get to the point where, like, oh man, I wouldn't even be named in the article. That's not good.
Right.
You know? Comedian Tim Meadows and fat guy die in crash. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to get. So I went until I got all the way back to the hotel after I hadn't killed him and I told him that story and he thought it was funny. And then this whole time I'm worried about killing you, man, because two celebrities just died and I was afraid you're going to be the third one. And it was going to be my fault.
That's hilarious. Who was your favorite person that you got to like know on some level from that side of the business?
I mean, comic wise?
Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoyed becoming friends with Gary Goldman.
Yeah.
And he's a guy that, you know, so that was cool. You know, Kreischer weeks were always crazy when we finally got him. You know, we do the $2 shots upstairs if you're not wearing a shirt. That was always funny.
He's so much fun.
So he was fun to hang out with. You know, I mean, I've always liked Tom Simmons was always fun to come in town, or Kostocki, or, you know, I mean, it was cool that, like, these people became our friends, a lot of them. You
yeah.
know? And there was guys, I mean, I thought Joel McHale was really fun, actually. Like, he was a cool guy to hang out. I only got to hang out with him one day because I went to New Orleans on Saturday, but, you what know, I picked him up from the airport, and he just was a really cool, down-to-earth, nice dude.
What about the crazy night at the piano bar?
With when Craig Robinson?
Craig Robinson.
That was a lot of fun, yeah.
Do you want to tell that story?
Well,
that's
insane. Well, we used to, like, one of the things is you know, we just were a party club. So, like, you know, we tried to make it because, I mean, when you travel and you've done, I mean, you go and the club doesn't really talk to you. The staff doesn't really talk to you. And part of that's by design. They don't want the staff fucking the comics because then right. it convolutes everything, which I get, I guess. But so usually you're just on an island by yourself. And if you're on the road and you don't know the feature you're working with or the MC, you've never met them. And a lot of times it's just lame. It just sucks. And, you know, mm-hmm. it's just like the crowd leaves instantly. No one talks to you really. And then you're like in Lansing and you got to go to your hotel or whatever. It just sucks. So we tried to make it not that, you know, I mean, we tried right. to take care of the comics. You know, the staff was encouraged to hang out with them and show them a good time. And then we'd always go to Broad or Liberal or whatever. And the place, this piano bar is where we always go. And it's, you know, dueling piano standard thing, you know. But Craig Robinson, who, you know, from The Office, who's just one of the funniest dudes on the planet.
Right.
But his show isn't really stand-up. He just plays songs and sings them, and then people kind of sing along with him. And he has some funny songs he sings, but a lot of it, he's just playing, you know, fucking Sweet Caroline, and everybody's singing it. It's
right.
just fun.
Yeah.
So he's basically like the greatest, most successful dueling piano player ever.
Who doesn't have to duel anybody.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, you know, we're like, hey, you want to go to the thing, and he was like, yeah, that'd be great. He's like, you think they'd let me play? And I'm like, absolutely let you play. So I went to my guy and I'm like, hey, I got Craig Robinson. If you want him to come in, he wouldn't mind playing. And they're like, well, yeah, of course. So we brought him in through the kitchen, and then I introduced him, and he just played. He played till like 6 a.m. It was insane.
Jesus.
And like the whole place was packed. People were like, hurt. Craig Robinson's at the piano bar playing at the piano. And everybody would run down and like take pictures and selfies, and they'd run away. Like, and they were packed for a couple months after that, thinking more celebrities might show up.
Yeah.
But then we brought Brent Morin and Jason Collins there too, and they sang and just had a great time. So we always, the piano bar is always fun, but we just always try to take the comics out and make them have a good time,
yeah.
which I think is funny. I think some of them didn't like it. That's what's so funny. Like, now that we
right.
like the Helium's here, and I'll go hang out with some of those guys that I kind of know, but I'm not the owner anymore. I'm
right.
like, hey, we're going out here have some beers. They're like, I'm just going back to the hotel and chill. I think a lot of people went out with us out of obligation. Like, they didn't want to go.
Yeah, I think some
get.
Of them felt
it's
like
so funny to me,
I have to do this to come back.
Which is true. They totally did. I mean, especially as the feature. I mean, that's what I tell people all the time. Like, the feature, if you're not going to have a good time, I mean, that's the thing. People understand it's a numbers game. We're talking about funny again. Like,
right.
there's 52 weeks a year. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the end of Morty's, we had 75 comics that I wanted to headline every year and 120 comics I wanted to feature every year.
Right.
I don't have that many spaces. So at some point, it's there. If you give me any reason not to book you, so anybody who's ever late consistently, I don't need to deal with that. You
right.
know? So we just wouldn't book them back. Or if you were an asshole, or you were a dick to the staff, or you weren't fun. I mean, you know, there were guys, I mean, Gary Goldman never went out and partied. He was so fucking great that. You know,
sure. But we would do – we had a little ritual. It would always be Cheesecake Factory lunch.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, but he would hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely a guy who would hang out, which was part of it. I mean, especially since it was our clubhouse. I wasn't trying to make money. This was like so I could hang out with comics and do cool shit.
Right.
You know what I mean? So once it even – I mean, it was like that, going to be like that anyway. But then once we changed it to, yeah, we're not even trying to make money really because
right.
we don't have that option.
You know, and I've heard guys – oh, Tom Simmons likes to give us hell over it. Like, oh, yeah, you had to go there and party, or, you know, you weren't going to be invited back. But I don't see anything wrong with that, because every club has its own little thing, right? And like you said, there's not enough spots for the people that you want to work. So there has to be some criteria. And if you weren't just so awesome to watch at comedy that stood on its own, you were going to have to be a fun person to hang out with, because we were all about hanging out all weekend.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I don't think so either. I mean, you know, my uncle was a managing partner of a law firm for a long time. And his first year as the managing partner, they're like, well, to hire summer interns to like be law clerks, which is a pretty cool job. You know, they'd get 1,000 applications and they'd narrow it down to the top 10. Well, the time you got to the top 10, they're all exactly the same.
Right.
Right. And that's what these comics are. They're all exactly the same amount of funny. Like, mm-hmm. there are guys that rise to the top. Gary Goldman's one of them.
Sure.
So he doesn't have, I mean, but, you know, there's guys that rise to the top, and there's guys that are, they just kill like everybody else. Okay. Well, they're a killer. But so anyway, so then
but
you
they're
get
the, not fun.
Yeah. So they get the so my uncle, they have these 10 guys, right? Or 10 law candidates, women and guys. And so the first year he was a partner, what they used to do is they would go to lunch at the really fancy restaurant in Dayton, Ohio, where the law firm was at the Racquet Club. And the first year, my uncle was like, hey, let's see if we can trick them into ordering dessert, and then we don't order any and see if that'd be fun, right? And so they just, oh, the cheesecake here is amazing for the very beginning. You got to try the cheesecake. It's going to be great. And then you know, they're going to hire two of these 10 people, and out of the 10 people, two of them asked, are you going to have any dessert?
Oh, smart.
And the other eight just ordered it. Yeah, I'll have the cheesecake. And they all went, no, we're good, we're good, we're good. And then they just watched this person awkwardly eat cheesecake by themselves because they figured they...
no way I'm getting this job and I'm going to eat the shit out of this cheesecake.
Well, but at first they thought they just wanted to see how they would react. Like, right. Were they making a joke about it, whatever. But then once the two asked the question, my dad was like, or my uncle was like, yeah, that's kind of the question that a lawyer should ask. You're always worried about right. Whether somebody's going to fuck you or not, mm-hmm. Right? So you should have that kind of like, oh, yeah. What's up here? You having dessert? Right? And so that became the test because everything else was exactly equal. So it's right. Weird. Like that, sometimes that happens where it's got to be some weird metric
right.
That you can't, it's not just funny because funny, again, and funny is so subjective too.
Sure.
I mean, you know, the things I find are funny doesn't mean everybody's going to find them funny. I mean, I have right. A very specific comedy taste and
bottom line, I just don't think you can cry discrimination for not being fun. Like if that's our criteria, you know, it's not religious based. We don't care what your sexual preference is. It's got to be fun.
Yeah. Which I mean, I would assume that, you know, fun and stand up comics should kind of go hand in hand. I mean,
but it doesn't.
It doesn't. That's the weird part. You know, it's like somebody was talking to tell me about they know a cam girl or something that doesn't like to have sex. And I'm like, yeah, there's lots of comics that aren't funny.
Yeah, it makes
you
sense.
Know what I mean? Like, just because you're good at it doesn't mean right. You like doing it. I mean, it's like we were talking yesterday about football players, you know, where there's guys that are better than they are, they're better than they want it.
Right.
And there's guys that want it more than they are good.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, guys like Ricky Williams or whoever that were just way better than they wanted to do it. They didn't want to work hard. They were just athletic specimens.
Right.
And then you got guys, you know, like Tom Brady or whoever who just work their ass off because they wanted it more than, you know, their abilities.
Yeah.
And so I think there are comics like that too. They're just naturally funny on stage, but don't really have much out of that after the word.
Right.
You know,
what do you like? So right now in the pandemic, you guys are you and Steve Hofstetter and Ben Glebe, former host of Idiot Test. You guys are kind of killing it right now with the social distancing social club, which is, I don't know how to describe it. It's a show that obviously showcases stand-up comics. You usually have two, if not three, doing a 5-6 minute set. And then sometimes you have guest panelists. But it's kind of a mix between, I don't know, like game show / late night
you know what we're
TV
doing,
show.
Todd, we're just basically doing the Bob and Tom show from the 80s.
Wow, that's
but
a good way to
video,
put it. Yeah.
Because it's me, Ben, and Steve, and then Rachel. So Rachel's our Christy Lee. She reads the news, essentially, reads all the tips and that kind of stuff. And
right.
Then you've got I'm the laugher, like Bob was. Steve's Tom. He kind of runs the show. And then mm-hmm. Ben's Chick McGee. He's just kind of a weirdo that does
yeah.
fun shit. You
bit
know?
Of a curmudgeon.
Yeah. And I mean, we're not exactly the same, but that's kind of that kind of idea
sure.
where we have comics on then laugh at their jokes, which is what – you know, Bob and Tom was for sure in the 80s. It is like that now, sometimes still, but like
right.
it was in the 80s, it was 90s. It was way more bring a comic on, tell them the jokes. They, you know, laugh at those jokes and then talk to the comic. And that's basically what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's just video. So it's on Zoom. But it's cool because we don't have to be like it's this whole new idea now that you don't have to be in the same room. Like
right.
even you, when you started, when I moved away, you're like, oh, well, I got to do podcasting. We have to be in the studio together. So.
I was so against it, right?
And now with StreamYard or whatever, you can, and Zoom, you can do them now. But again, the technology had to catch up to it. Now people know what
sure.
they're doing. And I had to buy the right equipment. Like we still have people that come on the show and they're still on their phone and it just doesn't work that way. You
right.
have to have a laptop. You got to mm-hmm. have lighting. You got to have a microphone that plugs in. There's certain things you got to have. It costs you a couple grand. But once you do that, you know.
Right.
Now I can do podcasts with you. I can do this show. I mean, so there's a lot of different ways to do it. And it has been a lot of fun. I mean, but also, too, we've just kind of carved out a little group. It's not even like we're
well, that's what I really love about it. It's become like literally a club. Like these people, you have this, these, you know, I don't know how many thousand people.
I mean, there's probably 400 people that watch it religiously, but we get 20,000 or more views.
Right.
Now, I don't know how many of those are just watching for a second and turning off, but these people then have become friends with each other. And there's, yeah, it's just, it's a community. We've built this little community that we're the stars of.
Right.
And
you bring in new faces for them to learn. So those people, you know, if they come on and knock it out of the park, they leave with some fans they didn't have before.
Yeah.
Like it's doing well for everybody. You guys are able to live off of it right now. You're making money, successful show. I just think it's brilliant. When you first told it to me, you know how I get sometimes, I'm just like, this is going to work for a few weeks, but then it's going to die off. You kept telling me, no, I think even after there's no more COVID, shows like this will survive. And I agree now.
Right.
Shows like yours will survive. All the others are going to die off because they're not as good. They haven't put as much into it.
Yeah. I mean, we got lucky in that Steve had an audience already. And then, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, our first episode had 20,000 views or whatever, which again, it's easy to make 20,000 followers into 40,000 followers as opposed to making one into fucking 10. That's
right,
the point.
Right.
Like once you have a bunch of something, I mean, Steve's been building this for 15 years. I mean, he's been really good at it, and he's, you know, Steve's a great dude, and he's let us kind of ride his coattails. I mean, he could have done all this on his own, and he's like, nah, I'd rather have people help me support it. Whatever.
Sure. Yeah. He's kind of a team guy.
Yeah, for sure. And so it just kind of built into this kind of cool thing. And like I said, the first 3 months of the pandemic, and I think until recently, and I'm not even sure it doesn't still go on every time, but there's a chat, a Zoom link that just runs 24/7 that people are in all the time from all over the world that are all now friends.
It's cool,
you know?
Right?
Yeah, it's really cool. And they know each other. And it's also, too, you can be in the front row with Zoom. So if you're in the front row, we have people that are fans of our show that in that world, they're famous now.
Sure.
Like in that one. I mean, and again, it's a small world, but that's kind of how the whole world. I mean, you know, I've always joked that like, there's probably as many people that listen to comedy or really into comedy as there are that really into dog shows.
Right.
It's about the same group of people, the same amount probably, you know, and if you see a famous dog show guy at an airport, they're like, oh my God, that's him.
Right.
Right. But like nobody else knows who they are, you know, and that's comedy and that's now this little group. It's a smaller group. But on some level, I think the people just want to feel like they belong to something. And this gives them an opportunity to do that. So I think we could have a whole run of stuff where it's like guys do a pot. Because, again, it's Patreon-based. It's tip-based. So it's not like, okay, I got to have 2 million listeners for this to get an ad for Dollar Shave Club or whatever. Literally, we do a show to 400 people and they pay us, you know, they give us a couple $100 an episode and tips to keep the show going.
Yeah.
You know, and we auction off stuff that we've used on the show. We do other little things like that to make a little bit of money, but we have a merch store and that kind of stuff. But like our little group just pays for it, you know, and if we could make it bigger, that'd be great, but we could survive with just what we have. So like as an artist, you can say, okay, if I've got two, like my buddy Trevor, who is in O-Town,
right?
Trevor Penning. And we just started him a Patreon because he's got about, you know, 200 to 500 really diehard fans from the old O-Town days.
Right.
You know, and it's like, and that's what Patreon is now, is it's not, I mean, you get stuff for it, but it's basically saying, hey, support your favorite artist so they can keep producing stuff and they don't have to either have commercials on their shows or they don't have to go work at a restaurant, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great thing. Whoever came up with it, I mean, let's. Yeah. The moment it hit, it started doing well. And there's a reason. It's patronage. I mean, that's existed since the beginning of the arts, you know? There's been patronage and to keep people working and making art. And I just feeds off of that.
Yeah, and that was a lot of times one rich person saying, hey, I want you to create this thing, which some of our greatest art came from that. And that's great. You know, if you look at the Renaissance or whatever. And this is a way to say, you know, you don't have to sell out. You can do it on your own with the people who enjoy your comedy and build it in a way or any art you're talking about. And what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do right now, and I've got another thing we're working on as well, is I want to create what I'm calling an artist middle class. Like right now, as if you're an artist of any kind, really, you make nothing till you make a ton.
There's no
middle ground. You're either Joe Rogan and you just sold your shit for $122 million or whatever, or you're Chris Bowers and you got $14 in your bank account.
Right.
Like, there's not really a lot of middle ground. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you could maybe gain some traction like on stuff like this. I know when you guys were on Pat Show or whatever, you know, we got some but still it's just a tough.
Yeah, very tough.
You know, so I'd like to create an opportunity where people could make $45,000 a year, which is what they're doing, waiting tables or whatever the hell they're doing.
Right.
Right. Or even selling T-shirts where they didn't have to sell T-shirts. They could actually just write jokes and go and perform. And, you know, there's people that are fans of their comedy that are letting them.
Comedy needs that because, you know, that existed for when comedy was doing great and everybody just went to the comedy clubs because that was, you know, a viable form of live entertainment. But that's gone now. Right. Like comics used to be able to make 60 grand a year by just being a decent comedian. Because they worked 42, 46 weeks a year.
Yeah, or they do cruise ships or whatever. But now
you really can't do that like you used to. You know, right. There are still some people that eke it out. But for the most part, they are riding the coattails of, you know, their career. They're chasing these, you know, these club weeks keep coming back because they've been doing the club for 22 years.
Right.
And those people still go. But you don't see new people developing. There is going to be no middle class for this new breed.
Right. And you're saying the road dogs and those guys, and I agree with that. I mean,
they can't do it anymore. We continually have conversations where we're like, oh, I just talked to so-and-so, you know, and they've been doing comedy 30 years and they're like, I can't make a living like I used to, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's where, because right now to be a touring comic, you have to be able to sell 2,000 or 3,000 tickets.
Right.
And with a Patreon, you know, it's not about that now, you know, because you might only have to have 50 Patreons to make. I mean, if 50 Patreons gave you $100 a month,
right?
You're good.
You're living middle class. Yeah.
And you're in the middle class and you can just work on your and just provide content for just them.
Right.
You don't have to drive to fucking Akron and hope those people also think you're funny.
Right.
You know, and so I think that's where we can what I want to try to see happen is the markets. Because you don't need that many people, you know. I mean, they always say if you can find 1,000 people to spend $100 a year on you,
mm-hmm.
on whatever it is you're doing,
well, there you go.
You'll make a living. So it's like, okay, well, let's try to figure out how to do that without having to sell, you know, have 200,000 listeners or 1,000,000 listeners or whatever. How do you do that if you've got 50 people that really like you, you know? And by the way, there's how many open mic or comics have we seen that have 45 people that fucking love them?
Right.
Well, you could just do that. You just perform mm-hmm. to those people and do the things you need to, and try to do other stuff. But like you make your living off those people that really love you.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's a great model.
200, great. But I mean, if you can make it around by having 50 people that love you and just keep making them laugh. I mean, that's kind of what we've been doing, you know.
I think it's a working model. And you guys are the first that I've seen really make it work. And again, now Steve has a bigger, you know, huge following from YouTube and Facebook, but still he's not this
household name. He's not
somebody
that you would know, but he probably makes more money than almost all touring comedians.
Exactly.
Bert Kreischer.
Right.
But you know, and Bert for years was making a little bit of money on his TV stuff, and you know, now he's finally kind of broken through with mm-hmm. actual money and you know, and also too, I don't want to have to play arenas. I think that's the other thing cool too is like if you can keep it smaller, I like small clubs. I like small clubs with 80 to 100 people in them, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, a 300-person club's cool, I guess, but there's always that more chance that somebody's going to yell something out or people are going to hear in the back or the service is going to be slow or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When it's sold out, it's always more of a pain in the ass. I mean, you don't want 12 people. I mean, I can do it with 12, but like, you know, but that sweet spot.
I think right around 80 to 100 is a sweet spot.
Yeah, it's sure. a lot of fun.
Especially if that fills the room.
Yeah, if the room feels full and they're there to have a good time and everyone's having a fun experience and everybody can hear and everybody's can see and – you know, it's just we're all having a fun time. We're all having the same time at the same time.
Right.
That makes sense.
And here's why some people don't realize, like, let's say you get the bigger comedy clubs that seat 300 to 400 people and it's full. Check drop is a nightmare for the comedian. Like, that's what people don't think about. Like, now that's why another reason why an 80 to 100 person room way better, because that 300, you got 380 people and that room is full and those checks all drop at once. You just might as well shut down your set for 15 minutes where you just got to walk around and talk about nothing important because people are only halfway listening. And that's almost devastating to your set, but it's just part of it. But an 80 to 100 person show, they still can engage.
And for the most, and also that happens at the beginning of the show too, because you also got a 15-minute spot where 300 people are also ordering drinks and food at the same time.
Like the MC is just not getting anything.
You know, and now sometimes those shows work better because people are squished together, which makes people laugh more. That's the thing people don't understand about comedy clubs. The reason they stick you together so close is because that's what generates laughter.
Right.
When you're slightly uncomfortable, you laugh more than you do when you don't. That's mm-hmm. why you don't laugh as loud at home by yourself on your couch. But when you're sitting right next to somebody you don't know and their legs touching your leg, that's a little uncomfortable. So right. the only reaction is, ha, ha, ha. You know, you tend to laugh more. That's why we stuff you together. It's
and
scientific.
COVID comedy is totally the opposite of that. Like,
right.
It disobeys every comedy club rule.
Yeah, all the things keep people
works,
close. And
like cramming people together.
Yeah, and low ceilings and all that stuff is not COVID yeah. compliant.
Now we need a retractable roof. We need to skip every other table. Like it feels weird. And I don't think people notice it as bad that when they're sitting in the crowd, but we notice it. Like the laugh sounds different. The people aren't as flammable, I guess, you know. Like you can't catch fire. No. In a room where there's just pockets of people.
Yeah, you can't spin the wheel quite as hard as you can right. when, you know.
Yeah.
You can still get it done. It's just a little harder.
And, sure. What do you like, let people know, like, your comedy. Where does it come from for you? Because you have a bit of your own style, and it's a little bit contrarian, would you say?
I the way I describe it is what I do is I call a magic trick for your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to tell you, I try to make a statement you don't agree with. And then by the end of the joke, you at least see my point of view.
Right.
Where I'll say something ridiculous where you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? And by the end, you're like, okay. And I just show my work essentially. So that's yeah. what I'm doing. I'm just doing story problems on the board. I show my work. And by the end, you're like, okay, I'm not sure I totally believe what you're saying, but
I see that you have some, yeah, I'll give it some validity. Yeah.
So, but I always like to take the opposite angle, what everyone else would take. So right. like, you know, we remember we taught that Todd and I, one time Morty sold a Groupon to stand-up comedy classes that me and Todd took. And we thought it'd be like a bunch of young people wanted to be comics, but it was a bunch of families of like middle-aged women who bought their aunt's funny, so they bought her this Groupon right. for Christmas as yeah. a present. And so, you know, it was one of the women that she'd had a brain tumor or whatever, and like, you know, I remember we had her say, instead of talking about how terrible it was to have a brain tumor, let's write a joke about the fun things about a brain tumor.
Right.
Because that's not the angle anybody else would take. So like, I don't write jokes. I mean, all my jokes are about how awesome COVID has been and how right. great the quarantine is, not as about how terrible it was.
Yeah.
Because that's what everybody else is going to do. So I try to like take the opposite take. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I try to use your own body. I guess that's a jiu-jitsu thing, right? But I try to use your own body weight against you on some level. So mm-hmm. like when I argue with people, I try to use whatever belief they already have against them. So I don't like, you know, like, so if we're going to argue whatever, I don't just do the standard.
Like abortion, just say.
Yeah, if we're doing abortion, I would say, okay, we'll start this way. Life starts at conception, abortion is murder, and the mother's soul's going to hell. Here's why it shouldn't be illegal. Well, I've just took away all three of their arguments.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And so that's where it's like, you know, and whether I believe those things or not, I mean, like my favorite thing right now to do is if someone puts on Facebook something about how churches should be against gays, but it's not a Catholic church,
right?
Then I just go, I think it's adorable when non-Catholic think they're going to heaven. It's hilarious. Like you guys arguing about who can have sex with who is so funny. It's like cats arguing about who they should fuck. None of you are going to heaven. You're cats, right? And just, no, that's not the – and I'll just argue like, no, there's one true church. It was from Peter. But like I'm just going the opposite. They've never argued someone more religious than them.
Right, right.
Just telling them they're going to hell because their decisions are wrong. That's usually their job. So it just flummox them. So that's kind of what I try to do. Is I try to use your kind of a roll you into your own beliefs.
Right.
Use that to put something else in your brain is my goal. So
I love it. Who's your favorite people doing it right now?
As I said, like Gary Goldman a lot. I think Neil Brennan, he really impressed me. I think Neil's funny anyway. And then before the pandemic started, he was doing a thing where he would do new material every Wednesday at the Santa Monica Comedy, Westside Comedy Theater. And I used to go there all the time and I'd go watch that show. And just to watch him build a joke was really good.
Oh, I can't imagine. Like, it's like just the fact that he was co-creator of the Chappelle Show. I mean,
yeah.
He has to have one of the greatest comedy brains ever.
Yeah. And just to, but what was great about it as a, you know, guy who's 10, 12 years into comedy and, you know, a headliner or whatever, to watch somebody at that level start the same way we start. with a joke that may or may not work.
Right.
And he's crossing shit off his list like, nope, that's not good.
Yeah.
And then to watch him like find the punchline that really makes this thing great.
Mm-hmm.
Like to, it's like a master's class in comedy. Like it's just such a great thing to watch him develop it.
Right.
Like it's, I mean, all these comics that go to all these open mics and stuff, my theory, I mean, I guess that's good. But like, I think good stage time is important. I think bad stage time is not good for you. I don't think bad stage time is worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, the first 100 times you go on stage, sure, you can take any stage you want. But once you've got established and you're good, I don't think going to shitty open mics helps you.
Right. I formed bad habits more.
And you'd start talking to the back of the room and it gets real insidey and weird. So, but watching, I would have you, if I was going to, I would say go watch Neil Brennan develop material. Go watch some of these greats. Start, I mean, Gary Goldman should. Gary Goldman would start on Thursday with an idea. And by Saturday night, second show, it's a polished fucking bit that's going to go on an album. And to watch him do that. That's the part I don't think people understand about comedy. Like comedy is the only art form where we have to practice in front of people.
Right.
I can write all the jokes I want, but until I do it in front of you, I don't know if it's funny or not.
Yeah, you can't refine it. You can't tool it down. Like that was the great thing about Gary Goldman was you could watch him on Thursday and he would try the punchline this way. And then he would be different for the Friday early show and different for just him seeing which way works best. And I mean, it was masterful. I mean, yeah, nobody does it.
And he's
like
a whole other level. Like, I'm just talking about like a joke that doesn't work and then slowly find this word makes it work and whatever. Where he had a joke that would work and still change words to make it even better.
Right.
I'm not even at that level. I'm not even like enough of a worker to do that. I just got to, oh, this doesn't work quite well yet. How do I?
Because in your head, you're like, okay, you put it together in your head. You're like, I think this is the way it goes. I think this is very funny. But you never know until you tell in front of people. Yeah. Like there's just so much psychology that plays into it, which we love. And to me, that's the beautiful thing of stand-up is when you can consistently enough go on stage to be able to do that. Like right now, that's what's driving me crazy about stand-up. I can't like write much new material. I mean, I could, but I would just be puking fresh thoughts to the crowd that entire weekend.
Right.
Like new material has to be constant.
Well, you got to do it 20 times.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like now that I've got this little bit of following, right? Mm-hmm. I could do a comedy show every Tuesday and they would come to it.
Right.
I could sell 30 tickets a week, but it's the same 30 people. I need a fresh 30 people that I don't know. Cause also once they're fans of you, they laugh just cause they like you.
Right.
So I need 30 people I don't know that don't know me 10 different times to refine a joke. I need it 10 times in a row where I can change things out. And, oh, this doesn't quite work, but this does work. And then after 10 times, I got it, but it has to be fresh people every time. And that's part of it too. I don't want to do it on Zoom because that's recorded or it could be.
Right.
And sometimes jokes start awful. And I mean, like, you're a terrible person. I can't believe you'd bring that up. I don't want to be friends with you anymore. Awful.
Right.
And you shave them up and you rub them down till they work.
Right.
You know, you got to massage them into like, okay, that was too harsh of a word, but if I say this, then it's funny.
Right.
You know, that's a whole other process and you can't really do that without people.
Yeah.
You know,
I always wanted to do this. I don't, man, we should try it, but it's going to be a big gamble because what if we suck at it? This is going to be, I like how you and I write jokes together.
Yes.
Nothing. So I was thinking maybe we just find something in the room or some obscure topic and together let's try to write a joke. Do you want to try it?
We can try it, yeah.
We could always cut this out if it doesn't work.
I mean, do you have something you've been working on? I mean, we could also, if we got something we've been working on, we could go back and forth with some of that.
Let me grab my phone. Let me see if I got just some fresh ideas going on in here. Because our gift is when we work together and writing jokes. We used to run these workshops for young comedians, and we were so good at using our brains together to make their jokes better.
Yeah, because I was really good at telling you which direction to go to make it funny, but Todd was just the hammer punchline guy.
Right.
You know?
So I'm looking at – I've got several – I always start new ones. I have like 27 new jokes.
Nice.
Blocks in my notes app. So, okay. Here's just a fresh thought. I wrote down, I'm scared of heights, which is a phobia that sucks to have, but it's very reasonable to have. Explore unreasonable phobias. That's what I put. Sorry. So I'm scared of heights, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I should talk about that on stage. I should have a big, because As far as phobias go, it's by no means, in my head, like unreasonable. Like fucking, yeah, if you're really high up and you fall, you're going to get fucked up. Like that's...
Yeah, being scared of heights is why your answers to being scared of heights is why you're here.
Yeah.
Because your ancestors that weren't scared of heights are dead.
Right.
So they didn't have kids. So,
right.
So the McComas name has lived on throughout history, mostly because we didn't climb up on shit because we were afraid.
We come from a long line of people that didn't climb high.
Right. Yeah. Right. So like, you know, it's so that's, I think you go at it from that angle, like the evolutionary advantage.
Yeah.
You know, of, but what other phobias, like spiders, I guess makes sense. Some of them are poisonous, you know, snakes, same thing, but like, you know,
So they look at the unreasonable ones. Like, what's an unreasonable phobia that someone has that just no reason for it? Like, why would you be scared of this thing? Oh, birds. All right. So, like, regular birds. Because I think I've told this story before, but my guy I went to school with, Richard Ruffin, he terrified of birds. He had watched the Hitchcock movie when he was a kid, Birds, where regular sparrows and shit would come down and poke your – or pick your eyes out.
Right.
And – So like one day we're with gym class and – oh, no, he was the manager for the baseball team, I think. And so we're having to do indoor gym practice. It's still winter technically. So we're breaking out gear, whatever. And a bird had gotten into the gym and it was flying around at the roof or whatever. And dude lost his – he was like, ah! He just goes running like he was – you could tell this dude's terrified.
Right, right, right.
So – to me, that's an unreasonable phobia that I could bring into this.
Yeah, I think that's one. Yeah, for sure. And maybe talk about the evolution side of that. Like, how's that help you evolutionarily to be scared of birds?
Right.
Because no one's going to fuck the guy that sees a bird and goes, ah! You're like, you're not getting laid if you're fucking afraid of birds. How'd you get here, bird man? You know what I mean? Like, that's, I think that's how you go at it. You know, and there's and then probably a bunch of other phobias. And then that I think a big hammer at the end, you could be like, I mean, there's unreasonable fear. Like fucking all of my wives have been afraid of me cheating, have had a phobia about me cheating. Now, sometimes it happens, sure, but I think it was unreal. I don't know. There's something, something in there, like a self-deprecating joke about your wives being afraid. I'm afraid of dishes, or at least that's what my wife would tell me, or whatever. I don't know. There's something in there. There's probably a you know.
Right. Yeah. I really, it's something I've explored several times, but I've never even began to flesh out. Like, but it's a real part of me. Like, I am very, very scared of heights. Like, even when if I get to, you know, the top of a 8-foot ladder, I get pretty freaked out.
Wait, is this why you don't like tall girls?
Yeah, see, that could be it. I don't like really tall women. That could be it. They remind me of high things.
She's going to lift me up and then I'm going to be too high and I'm afraid.
What if I fall off of you?
There you go. That's the ending.
So yeah.
You do it about that. You go like, now I will say my fear of heights has kept me away from tall women my whole life, which probably helped, but probably hurt me or
right, yeah.
Something in there. But
I'm always scared of falling off of them. Like, can you imagine who was the tallest woman in the world for a long time? Sandy Allen. It's like 7'4" right. Or whatever. Like, I mean, terrifying. As a kid, I found her terrifying. Like, and she's from my hometown, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So you had a shot is what you're saying.
Maybe, but I just can't. Those big ass hands on me. And there are some really hot WNBA players, like beautiful women, supermodels, some of them, you know, they're 6'3" or whatever, but it's just the, deeper voice and the big long fingers on your face just makes me want to throw up. Creeps me out. Gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, I know. That and bridges. You don't like driving over bridges either. So
no, I don't. Nothing high. Maybe that's, yeah. So I need to, yeah, we'll flesh that out some more. But that's just an example of how, you know, going back and forth with somebody is very important in comedy writing. Like, because you'll get your mind locked in one direction. And then all I need is for you to say one thing and it opens another door that I would have never gotten to.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I've got one. And this started happening yesterday. I've had this idea for a while, but I think I figured out how to get it to be funny yesterday. So I was telling a story about how I was doing this fundraiser thing for whatever, and I ended up in a breakout room with Ed Helms, for about 15 minutes. And I just was like playing Madden. I was just supposed to be in this breakout room and Casey came in there, whatever. And I hear hello and I look up and it's just Ed Helms. It was me and Ed Helms on a Zoom, which is really cool. And I was telling the story of this guy yesterday. I met at the bar and he was like, oh, did you say or whatever and say his catchphrase? And I'm like, well, no, of course I didn't do that. And that's the problem is that's why celebrities are assholes to people.
Right.
And this kid's name was Elliot. I go, your name's Elliot, right? He goes, yeah. I said, you're 24? I go, yeah. Are you too old to know or too young to know what E.T. is? He's like, no, I fucking hate E.T. Every time I meet anybody, like, oh, Elliot, phone home. They say it every fucking time. I go, yeah, that's your do-ka-do-ka-do or whatever. Right. You know what I mean? That's your what people say to help. That's why celebrities are so mad is because, like, and so, like, the way I had it before, because I hadn't used, like, because certain people do have that one thing with their name, and then people say the same fucking joke their whole life, and right. They hate it.
Right.
Right? But, like, you know, the thing I said originally was, like, that person in your family, every time the waiter comes over with pepper and goes, say when, they always go, when.
Right.
Right? Like, they invented it.
Yeah.
And, like, fuck that guy. Or, like, the person at your office goes, Mondays, huh? Mondays, huh? Well, if you're a celebrity, every day's Monday and fucking someone's always giving you pepper. So it's right. Just Mondays, huh? When? Mondays, huh? When? Phone home, Elliot. It's like, fuck, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
That's
I'm
why.
I'm going to beat you to death with this stapler.
Yeah. Like, and so I'm sure like that's what I'm saying. So like you can't. So if you want to be cool with celebrities, you cannot say they've just heard it a zillion times. You're not original if you're the guy that yells out, hey, phone home, Elliot.
Right.
Or fucking, you know, whatever their catchphrase is on their show. Like they don't want to say that.
Right.
They don't want to hear it. Only because they've heard it a zillion times.
Yeah.
So I don't know where to go with that as a joke, but I think that's a concept. You know what I mean? Like. But the Elliot thing is new because there are a lot of people that have a name that is part of a movie or something.
You know, for sure.
Whose name was Siri. And I'm like, how's your life going? She's like, pretty fucking terrible.
Actually. Right.
Because every single person's like, oh, Siri, how far is the gas station? And she's like, no, well, I'm going to murder you. Fucking that's how far it is, you fucking ass. Like, so that's where it's like.
So is that the bit or is the bit, I kind of like the, you know, your name being destroyed by. Something that someone's invented or something cultural that occurs. Like, you know, I love that there's beauty in the fact that that destroys people's lives because this movie took over the world and became the greatest, you know, movie of its kind for a decade.
Right.
And it ruined this dude.
Yeah. There's like guys named Forrest.
Yeah.
That.
Run,
everything was going
Forrest.
Great, and then for 15 years, every time anybody's like, run, Forrest, run.
Right.
They cannot run without someone yelling at them.
That's why Forrest Whitaker stopped working. he's still got a good career, I think.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, and maybe go into that first about people's names getting destroyed and be like, and that's why celebrities are dicks, because they don't, it's not their name, but everybody, because the point I want to make, and I might even end it with my, you know, the thing I've gotten on a couple of different albums about Jared from Subway, where I don't feel the thing I feel bad for is when he gets raped in prison every day for being a pedophile, which I agree with. They use the same $5 footlong joke every time they fucking rape him.
Right.
That would drive me crazy. Like, I think that's what the overall, I might even end with that. I don't know.
Right.
But the overall joke is just about like, quit thinking you're fucking brilliant when you say the thing that everyone else fucking says.
Right.
You know, like, uh-huh. Like it's like people that don't read the comment section of a post. Like if right. I go to a post and somebody said something, I've got some snarky comment, but there's 58 comments. I read all 58 to make sure somebody can already say the thing I'm going to say.
Right. I do the same thing.
It drives me nuts when like the same post will have 400 people going, huh, maybe you should go.
Yeah. Should have named him Noah or whatever.
Yeah. It's like when comics write, who books that is some joke on Facebook.
Right.
But like, okay, there's one who books that per post.
That's all you get.
You can't
read
four who books this. I'm sorry. You can't be that unoriginal.
Right.
Unless you're very first.
I couldn't agree more. I fucking hate that. And I'll do the same thing. It might take me an hour to read through these fucking.
And there's times where it's 58 comments and I'm like, I don't even care enough about this little snarky thing I was going to say to read all this shit.
Right.
And I don't even do it. Mm-hmm. But I would never comment without reading all the other comments to make sure I wasn't going to say something somebody else had said.
Right.
Because I just don't.
It's devastating to me to do that because
yeah.
I know how I view it when you do it on my shit. I'm like, ah, oh, come on, dude.
This right, because the guy who posted it reads all of it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but it's like right even now, like with anything political or whatever, I'll tweet because Steve, you know, is all over everything. He just sees every tweet. He sees every news story, whatever. So I'll just be like, hey, I was going to tweet this. Has this been done a billion times? And sometimes he's like, yep, seen it 100 times a day. And sometimes he's like, no, that's really good. We should put that out.
You know?
Because I don't want to tweet something that everybody else has tweeted.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing, going back to the comedy club, that's part of the reason. I think a lot of times comics, because they don't watch a lot of other comics,
mm-hmm.
and generally the bad ones don't watch anybody.
Right.
Right? So, like, they don't know they're doing the same joke as every other person.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's sometimes weird to me. Like, there's because and we'll, every so often we'll write a joke and be like, how has no one written this? This has got to be a joke, right? This is
right.
Somebody's had to have written it. You know, Haywood Banks used to have that great joke where he said, did you hear what Mitt Romney said when he got in Salt Lake City? Is it just me here or is it Mormon here?
Right.
Right. He goes, I was just sitting there, guys. I've been sitting here this whole time. I don't know why I was the one that just got picked it up and has been there this whole time. Like, but I think, you know, and you see this with social media or whatever, where the same people are making the same easy joke.
Right.
And that's what we try to teach those the people we were trying to teach was go down Fifth Street. Don't go down First Street. Don't, you know, the first thing you say is what your stupid uncle forwarded you a meme about already.
Yeah.
And the second thing you think is what an open mic comic would think. And the third thing you think is what an MC comic would think. And the fourth thing you think is what a feature would think. And the fifth thing you think is what a headliner would think. And that's what makes you a headliner.
Right.
It was amazing how many features would all have the same jokes about generic cereal or, you know, that if there's a warning label on something, that means somebody did that shit and whatever. And they all have the same 10 premises and they don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And they wonder why they don't get bumped up. And it's like, you have all the same jokes as somebody else.
Yeah. And, you know, it gets that way with ethnicity. Like, you know, you're the first Middle East comic, you think, that's come up. Like, you're literally saying the same things that everybody else that has your same ethnicity is doing.
Yeah.
Like, and I hate that when I hear it. I'm like, geez, you know, I see it like in the local scene here, somebody new. And I'm like, oh, come on.
Or just
consume a little bit to know that this has already been done to death.
Right. And part of that's that if they're not on the show with other people, that, I mean, part of the problem is since we have booked such lily white shows for so long, that your comic that's Indian doesn't see any other Indian comics because there's only one Indian comic per show. And so, again, same thing when there's only one feature, he thinks he's killing it. And he does. He does well. It's not the point of that. But he doesn't realize that he's being funny with the same print. Now he might have a different white joke's different. Yeah, your joke is different, but it's still the same kind of joke, right? And the same thing. Like, it's not that they, I mean, it's just like how many comics come up and go, I know what I look like so and so, had sex with so and so or whatever.
Yeah.
And they open with that. And it's just amazing how many, you know,
That's why I always encourage people, young comics, to go to festivals.
Yeah.
That's where you really learn, because now you are going to be around some other Indian comics.
Yeah.
And now you're going to see, oh, shit, he's also doing the customer service thing, you know? And then, you know, that you got to expand your horizons, basically.
Yeah, for sure. And then at festivals, I mean, I can't tell you how many festivals I've been to where – there's 10 comics on the lineup and 8 of the 10 will open up with, I know what I look like. I look like so-and-so. This girl gets it.
You know,
it's like you're doing all the same little tropes that every other comic has done. And they work. And that's the danger of comedy is that we all know the tricks that make everyone laugh.
Uh-huh.
The question is, can you try to do it without using any of the tricks?
Right.
And there's guys that don't. And by guys, I mean comics. There's comics that don't. They just use the tricks and it's, you know, they go in and it's just they're doing an imitation of what a comic is.
Yeah.
And there's people out there that make you think originally and make you laugh. You know, and I'm not saying I'm the most original person of all time. Most of my stuff's men and women stuff. But I think I have a unique take on it generally.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about censorship.
Okay.
Like what's going on? Like how do you view it? Because we talked a little bit about it last night, but – like before I got blacked out drunk. But so they're right now, Facebook or Twitter are deciding these accounts are dangerous. The things that they're saying incite people or whatever. And then they're taking them down. I'm not just using Trump as an example, but obviously it happened to his account on Twitter.
Right.
But do you think that social media should still be the Wild West, or are you okay with what's going on?
No, I think I said the other day, I mean, I think you have a right to speech. Obviously, I think everyone has a right to speech. I don't think you have a right to a bullhorn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, I mean, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You definitely shouldn't be given a bullhorn to yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
And that's essentially what was happening. I mean, it's like we own the comedy club. Like, I wasn't censoring people that I didn't let on my stage because I didn't think they were funny enough.
Right.
I wasn't censoring. You can go fucking talk wherever you want, but you don't automatically get my stage because you have the right to it. That's not how it works.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like if – and because it's not his bullhorn.
And you're saying, so Facebook to you or Twitter, there, it's like a venue. I mean, you have a right to reserve service or right to refuse service to anyone.
It's a venue. And but even that, it's not like, I don't think a venue has as much right to refuse service to the customers, but I definitely have a right to reserve what to say what comics go on stage and what gets said.
Right.
You know what I mean? Now, we would never, you know, use it to monitor political speech. But I mean, when Tom Simmons at one time got those death threats, I'm like, dude, don't argue with people in the crowd tonight and fucking make them want to shoot you. Stop it. Don't do that. And if you do that, I'm not going to be able to have you back.
Right.
And I just get this. People paid money to come laugh. They didn't come to get pissed off.
Right.
You know, and that's part of it. I mean, like your job is to make them laugh. It's your job is not to make them. I mean, you know, now if you can make them laugh by making them think, fucking great. Good job.
Right.
But I want them to laugh before I want them to think. If you can do both, cool. Right. But I don't want them just to leave going, yeah, that wasn't funny. And now I don't have a problem with saying, because we didn't take away their, we took away people's right to lie. You just can't lie, because we found out was we aren't smart enough and diligent enough to do the research. We can't have all these different, at some point, you know, you need to look, I mean, news organizations weren't allowed to report whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. They had to fact check all their shit, right?
Right.
And then we made everyone a news person with no fact checking.
Right.
So I think on some level, if we're not going to take our own responsibility, and again, the government didn't shut Twitter down. Like, if the government would have said kick Trump off Twitter, that's horse shit. Anyway, so I think things are way better than they were.
We're going to be fine.
100 years ago, people literally starved to death during the Great Depression, and
right,
you know, we're figuring it out slowly but surely. And
we're going to be fine. I just like to raise the arguments because there's just so much shit going on now. There's just so much to worry about. There's so much. Everybody has a voice, and it's so fucking much. But it's going to resolve itself, and I can't wait to see how. I just like guessing what's going to happen.
Yeah. When I say one little last plug on my social media thing, what I'm saying is, like, in June, I stopped posting on social media for the most part. I'll put a joke up, but I stopped posting, like, any sort of diatribe on anything. Uh-huh. And because what I realized is anybody I'm arguing with on social media, even if I convince them or they convince me, which doesn't happen very often, it doesn't change anything.
No.
It doesn't affect the world. If you and I decided right now that Donald, either that the election was stolen or it completely wasn't stolen, it doesn't make any fucking difference.
Right.
Convincing me or convincing you doesn't affect anything. Right. So I stopped reading it after the insurrection thing, after the thing at the Capitol. I stopped reading, and it's been a really good couple weeks. Like, no. I'm telling you, just stop reading social media shit.
Yeah.
Just quell your and I don't mean echo chamber it. I mean, like, just take all the people off your feed. Just you don't have to block
them. Mute them.
Just unfollow them. Mm-hmm. And then they see your stuff still, but you don't have to see their stuff. And just if it's a funny comedy joke or they're advertising shows and stuff you like, keep them. But everybody else, just unfollow them.
Yeah.
You know, you've got them on there if you need to communicate. If you want to send a message to your old buddy from high school, you can be like, hey, man, I'm going to be in town this weekend or whatever. It's a good communication tool. But don't use it to get information or news or anything else, because you don't ever know where the fuck that shit's coming from.
I need this country to heal a little bit. So everybody, if you don't, I'll say this. Just shut the fuck up for a little bit on your social media. Let what's going on work. Let's see what happens. There's no reason to fucking try to shoot it down if you're against it before you even see if it's going to work or not. Just shut up for a little while. I need a break. And let's see what happens. I can tell you right now, everything's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be better. The world is going to be better.
Well, here's the thing, Todd. Everything's going to be fine for some people, and everything's going to be terrible for other people. And that just shifts back and forth. But it's always the same case. I mean, there's plenty of people who the pandemic was great for. I'm one of them. This has been a great time for me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's times where there's people that this has destroyed their whole lives.
Right.
You know? So it's just and some of that's luck and some of that's adaptation and whatever.
Yep.
You know? But I mean, it's going to be fine probably for most of you.
Yeah. And if not, suck it up, buttercup. All right. Well, thanks for joining me, brother. I'm glad you're here for the week hanging out.
Yeah.
So let's drink some more. Let's party a little more before I got to take off to Kansas City.
Sure. And then if you guys want to watch my show, it's called the Social Distancing Social Club. It's on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, 3 p.m. Pacific, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday at noon Pacific. Just go to sdscshow.com and you can watch the links. It's a live show, so you'll.
It's great. Everybody should check it out.
It's a fun time. Todd's been on a couple times. It's a good time. We have two comics, and sometimes we have a celebrity show up and hang out with us. And, it's a fun time. And then you can follow me at Bowers Comedy on Instagram and Twitter and all that stuff. But again, I won't be posting much, and I won't be reading what you're saying. So. But I will be able to tell you if I'm in your town or whatever. That's what,
exactly.
You
know, that's
so,
all that matters.
So that's what's good is the.
And you can follow the SDSC show through that. So if you forget any of that, just check the episode description. There'll be links for all things Chris Bowers and SDSC. All right.
Sounds good, buddy.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.